This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park in Woodstock is Vermont's only national park, but its boosters say it deserves a place in the pantheon of great American parks because it celebrates an idea, conservation. In fact, on its website, the park calls one of its namesakes, George Perkins Marsh, the father of the American conservation movement. That may seem like hyperbole, especially given the other men often given that paternal honorific, including John Muir. But Marsh was very influential in the creation of the park system and in the idea of conserving the land for wildlife and for future generations. Today on the show, we're going to learn all about all three of the names behind this park, Marsh, Billings, and Rockefeller, and learn about why Vermont's lone national park is special. I'm joined now by Rick Kendall, superintendent of the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park and the National Park Service Stewardship Institute, and by Christina Martz, the park's deputy superintendent. Christina and Rick, welcome to you both.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks, Jane.
So let me just ask you first to get in the swing of things. What's actually happening at the park today? Christina, do you have stuff going on today?
We do. We are offering tours of the mansion and nature programs. We have a Nature of the Day today and some special guided programs to other hidden spaces within our museum collections. And, of course, our carriage roads and trails are open to the public for hiking as they are every day of the year.
And at this time of year, you must get a lot of school trips, so there must be a lot of yellow buses in June and late May pulling in and pulling out.
Truly, it's one of the best time of year to see those school groups come through and the teachers working with the students and using the park as their outdoor classroom.
Now, Rick, this park was not around when I was a young school child in Vermont, or at least it wasn't a national park. It was certainly around, but it was only opened as a national park in 1998. And it is, as I mentioned, the only park, or so I'm told, that's dedicated to a concept or an idea rather than the particular natural landscape or the events that happened there. So what does that really mean? How is a national park dedicated to a concept?
Well, to a certain extent, all of our national parks are dedicated to ideas and concepts. And some of those ideas are very concrete, like scenery or a story that goes along with a park. And some of them are a little more abstract, like Marsh Billings' story, for instance, which is about conservation and stewardship. And we get at that that story through the three individuals who are historically associated with the park, George Perkins Marsh, Frederick Billings, and Lawrence and Mary Rockefeller.
Well, let's just dive right in. But first, let me invite listeners to send us a note or give us a call if you have either a question about this park, maybe a question about those people, the Marshes, the Billings, the Rockefellers, and why they're so important to the conservation movement. We're going to talk about that. We'd also love to hear why you love the park, what you do there. Maybe you use those carriage trails. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Okay, so the three names that get the top billing in the park's name are all tied to that concept of conservation. So let's start with Marsh, the first one, George Perkins Marsh. Christina, who was he?
George Perkins Marsh was an amazing man and a really interesting character, and it's a pleasure to share a little bit about him because he is not well known in the lexicon of conservationist as he should be. He was born in 1801 on the property that would become the national park, and from a very young age, he was a very precocious boy, and he read like crazy, so much, in fact, that he actually damaged his eyesight. So it was at a young age of about 8 years old where he was forced outdoors and away from his books, and he took to the woods as he would a classroom, and he spent his time learning about the trees and the animals that lived on Mount Tom. And he would travel with his father on a carriage on those carriage roads and farm roads that crisscrossed the mountain. And his father taught him about the concept of watershed when they stopped one day at a prominent summit. And he asked George Perkins Marsh to look at the different flows of water as they crest the different hillsides. And George would later reflect that those lessons would stick with him for the rest of his life. And from that time, he really embraced a passion for learning and a passion for observing landscapes, particularly the relationship of people to the land. And that would hold with him. And he had a very eclectic career. He would go to college at Dartmouth. He would teach at Norwich University. He spent some time up in Burlington as a lawyer. He tried his hand at a number of different businesses, which ultimately failed. But he found his calling in public service. He served as a Vermont representative in the 1840s. And during that time, he helped to create the Smithsonian Institute to share the love of natural history and art and literature. And he would later go on to be a U.S. ambassador, first to the Ottoman Empire and then later to Italy. And it was during his travels as an ambassador abroad that he started to make comparisons between what he was seeing in those landscapes to what he was seeing in his boyhood home. And we have to remember that the landscape that George Perkins Marsh grew up in was very different than the landscape that we see today. Nearly 80% of the forest during that time was cut, first for potash and for timber to serve the budding farmsteads in the area, and later to make way for sheep grazing. And through his time in Vermont, George Perkins Marsh witnessed that drastic landscape change of his boyhood home. And it troubled him because he saw the erosion of soils, the loss of productivity in those farm sites, the effects on the riverways from sedimentation to absolute fish kills. And as he was traveling abroad, he was seeing some of those same trends in places that had hundreds of years of human habitation in those lands, and that had led from deforestation to desertification and were no longer inhabitable for the people there. He took all of those lessons in life from his boyhood days to his older days and traveling abroad to those landscapes, and he put pen to paper in 1864 and wrote a book called Man in Nature.
And this book, I mean, this was, you know, he may have been a politician at this point, an ambassador, and, you know, still known as a Vermonter, but this was a very influential book.
Completely. It was really one of the first times that anybody wrote about what today we would call modern ecology. So it was the first time that somebody made the link between the impacts of human activity and that of the environment. Some have called it the fountainhead of the American conservation movement. So it really touched off what today is our modern conservation movement. And it had profound effects in Marsh's time and then also in the decades following. The book was read by particularly those interested in forestry and reforestation and watershed work. So it informed the start of the first U.S. Forest Service. Gifford Pinchot was a big advocate of Marsh's writing and work. In fact, he was given a copy of Man and Nature on his 21st birthday, and it was he credits to inspiring his work on behalf of the U.S. Forest Service.
You know, he's often one of the men who is referred to as the father of American conservation. So, Rick, I want to bring you back in here just for a moment to say, I mean, it is the first thing on your website, on the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park website, that, you know, George Perkins Marsh is the father of the American conservation movement. Is that hyperbole, or do you think he was the one who got Gifford Pinchot and other people to really start to understand the importance of conservation?
Well, you know, when I look at the accomplishments of Marsh, I really compare a lot of his trajectory and how he went about his business to another person that's held up as a father of a discipline, and that's Charles Darwin, who, of course, sailed around the world, circumnavigating the globe on the Beagle, collecting a variety of data, and then spent 20, 25 years analyzing and building his case until he finally produced On the Origin of Species, around the same time that George Perkins Marsh produced Man and Nature. You know, George Perkins Marsh in the 1840s was starting to build his case. He actually spoke at an agricultural convention in Rutland, Vermont, telling farmers and other foresters that the work that they were doing in terms of cutting down and denuding hillsides was having a harsh impact on, soils and on erosion and on our water courses and watersheds. But it would be another 15 years before he had felt that he had built the case necessary to put his ideas out there in the form of Man and Nature. So when you think about the fact that he started in this journey in the late 1830s, early 1840s, and that Gifford Pinchot, who, like you said, was putting a lot of these practices into practice and taking Marsh's theory and putting it into practice, which is also what Frederick Billings did, I think the case can be made without hyperbole that Marsh is exactly as important as we say he is.
We got a note about that from a listener, and I want to invite other listeners who are thinking about conservation, thinking about the importance of conservation and the history of it, and how these Vermont men were so influential in their day and on into today. You can draw the connection to what's happening today in the National Park Service as we celebrate the 100th anniversary of the service this year. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Bruce says, I'm glad we have something honoring George Perkins Marsh here in Vermont, yet I'm struck by two ironies. First, Marsh was a harsh critic of railroads. He once wrote, my anathema on the scoundrel railroaders whom I loathe with all my soul. Therefore, if Marsh knew his name was associated with a railroad man in Billings, I wonder what he'd think. Second, Marsh's Man and Nature had a much greater impact on New Yorkers who were preserving the Adirondacks. Act 250 does not measure up alongside the forever wild provisions established in the New York Constitution. In some important ways, Marsh was a prophet without honor in his own land. Rick, do you agree?
Well, honor comes in a variety of different forms and fashions, and it comes at different times as well. The fact that Marsh can be held up now as one of the very few American individuals who is not a U.S. president to have their name and their house and their life's work immortalized and preserved for future generations in a national park, I think, is a great honor. And, I would tend to agree that Marsh is probably not or has not been as well known up until his name was included in the national park. But that's part of our job as the National Park Service is to get that word out there and to make him relevant not only to Vermonters but around the country.
We're going to get into the story of Frederick Billings coming up and then Lawrence and Mary French Rockefeller. We got a note from Beth Haylett, a teacher at the Woodstock Union Middle School, who writes in to say, the park is an extraordinary place with so many interesting elements that visitors from all over the world can enjoy. What many may not know is the way in which the park is connected to its community. The park has a tradition of working closely with teachers in our area to provide students of all ages learning opportunities that range from learning about life in the late 1800s and engaging in group games and challenges to collecting data for science experiments and serving as translators for park visitors. We also got a note from Heather who says, my husband and I first visited the park last summer as a weekend away from the kids. I happened to be training for a half marathon during that time. We hiked Mount Tom together and then I continued on running along all the magical carriage trails. I got so absorbed in the landscape and nature that I accidentally ran off trail and got lost. I eventually found a trail with goldenrod and blackberry bramble, only to realize I was following a bear and her cub. I finally made it down to the visitor center covered in bramble scratches and dirt, but glowing from the wonderful adventure. Looking forward to more runs there. This time, though, I'll stay on the trail. So you can tell us what you think of the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park. Maybe you have some adventures there. Maybe it's a field trip you went on as a kid. Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Rick Kendall and Christina Martz of the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park in Woodstock. If you have a question for them about the park or if you want to share your favorite memories, call 1-800-639-2211. 639-2211. That number again is 639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We can also talk about the state of the conservation movement today. But first, let's get to one of the other names, because these are names that in some cases are well-known. Rockefeller, most people know the Rockefeller name. The Marsh name, less well-known. Let's talk about the middle one, Frederick Billings. You know, he actually was a contemporary of George Perkins Marsh, although he was a little bit younger. And he made a name for himself mostly outside the state of Vermont. Christina, what was Frederick Billings all about?
Yeah, Frederick Billings actually grew up in South Royalton and later came to Woodstock. But he did make his name further afield. After receiving his law degree, he went to California right at the beginning of the gold rush. And that's really where Frederick Billings made his mint, where he set up his shingle and became the wealthy Frederick Billings that would then come back to Woodstock.
And by wealthy, I mean he was a millionaire, an actual millionaire in the day, which was pretty rare, right?
Correct. Yes, he was very well to do, and he put that wealth to capitalistic efforts as well as conservation efforts. In fact, while he was out in California, he helped to found Berkeley University, and he also took adventures further afield from the city into the Sierra Nevadas. And he fell in love with the area that would become the Yosemite Valley, so much so, in fact, that he hired a large landscape photographer to take an expedition out there and document the wonders of the Sierra Nevadas in these beautiful prints that are we still have on hand in the archives of the Billings Farm and Museum. And he had those prints packaged up in a portfolio that he then sent on to Congress, and together with himself and others, convinced those early congressmen during the height of the Civil War to set aside the Yosemite Valley as a federally designated protected lands. And so that was really the first time that the federal government took action to set aside a piece of land for its scenic and natural wonders, and truly the start of the idea of the National Park Service. Of course, the National Park Service wasn't an agency at that time. It would be a while later, and Yosemite would be brought in once the National Park Service was created in 1916.
Yeah, so, I mean, he made his name outside of the state, out west. He made a lot of money out there and was, as you said, Christina, so influential in the preservation of Yosemite and this idea of, you know, how you could sort of gin up support for preserving these spaces. But he also bought the mansion that George Perkins Marsh grew up in, and that is the mansion that you can see at the park today, and, you know, had this vision of conservation located there, Rick, right? I mean, he had this idea of conservation in Vermont as well, not just out west, but, you know, he was as disturbed by the sheep farming and clear cutting, and why did he think that we in Vermont needed to start thinking about conservation as well?
Well, again, it comes back to Marsh. You know, where Marsh was the theorist, Billings really took a lot of Marsh's theories and put them into practice in Woodstock at the Marsh Mansion. When, as a young boy, when Billings moved from South Royalton to Woodstock, he would look up at the mansion and say, one day when I'm successful, I'm going to buy that mansion and the land around it. And he came back a success, and he bought the mansion and the land around it, and he heavily renovated the mansion. But he put a lot more of his soul, I think, into renovating the landscape which had been nibbled close by sheep and hit by axe pretty hard. He put a lot of effort into replanting the forest using, you know, scientific forestry techniques of that time period, and also reestablishing the farm across the street as a scientific demonstration farm as well. So he put a lot of effort into turning the landscape around his property into, you know, a walking the walk kind of landscape, putting Marsh's ideals into practice.
So the Rockefeller in the name, if we can get to the third part of the name, Marsh Billings Rockefeller, comes from Lawrence Rockefeller and Mary French Rockefeller. And Mary was a granddaughter of Frederick Billings, so that's how they came to be tied to that property. Is that right?
That's correct. Frederick Billings died early on in his experiment on the hillsides of Mount Tom. And so his legacy was carried on by his wife, Julia, and three of their daughters. And the property stayed in the family and ultimately passed from Mary Billings to Mary Billings French to Mary Billings French. She later would then marry Lawrence Rockefeller, who came from the famous Rockefeller family and was one of the five sons of John D. Rockefeller Jr. Some of those sons went into politics, like Nelson, who became governor of New York, and Winthrop, who became governor of Arkansas. Some went into professional philanthropy or banking. But Lawrence decided to follow in his father's footsteps. John D. Rockefeller Jr. was one of the great early boosters and philanthropists for the National Park Service. He had given a tremendous amount of money and support towards buying land that would later become Grand Teton National Park. He gave money and support to the Great Smoky Mountains and Shenandoah National Park. The Rockefellers, were very instrumental in the establishment of Acadia National Park, which was the first big capital N, capital P national park east of the Mississippi River. And Lawrence really followed in his father's footsteps in terms of pushing their philanthropic works towards conservation as a major effort. And the property in Woodstock, though it came into the Rockefeller family through Mary's side of the family, became an important element of that and him carrying on the Billings legacy of managing that forest and the Billings Farm and Museum as well.
Given how tied this property has been to the conservation movement for so many years now and how preserved it was for so long, and the carriage trails were opened long before it was a national park, what took it so long till 1998 to actually become a national park, Christina?
Well, it was actually created in 1992. The legislation was passed to acknowledge the donation from Mr. and Mrs. Rockefeller to the National Park Service. But they retained life tenancy. The Rockefellers would return to Woodstock every summer to spend on the estate. This was very much Mary's place. So when they were still alive, they had a wonderful connection to the mansion and the landscape. They worked for the donation in 92, and as I mentioned, they kept their life tenancy. And then it was in 1997 that Mr. Rockefeller relinquished his life tenancy, and we were able to open to the public in 98.
Do you think this park is overlooked? Does it get its due in the National Park Service pantheon of great parks and in Vermont's outdoor spaces?
Well, there are 411 national parks in the United States, and of those 411, 59 of them are those big capital N, capital P national parks, what I like to call the greats, the grands, and the whys, the why parks like Yosemite and Yellowstone and the Grand Tetons and the Grand Canyon and the Great Smoky Mountains. And they do tend to get a lot more attention than many of the other parks out there. But when you look at the grand sweep of those 411 units, two-thirds of them are historical in nature, and they really try and tell the history of America, the things that we hold dear as a culture and as a people. And some of those parks that are in urban areas that have a larger base to draw upon probably get more visitation than those of us in smaller rural areas where people have to drive and actually come and seek us out. But I don't think that in any way diminishes the importance of the story that those smaller units that are a little bit further afield are set aside to protect.
Well, and certainly people who are there are enjoying it. We're talking about the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park and about this idea of conservation, how some of its roots come from right here in Vermont. In fact, from the park itself, from the mansion, from George Perkins Marsh and Frederick Billings. And we got a tweet from Ryan who says, I'm at the top of Mount Tom right now with an 8th grade class celebrating their completion of middle school. He's from the Woodstock Union High School and Middle School, and they are apparently up on Mount Tom right now. So we got a tweet from inside the park. How cool. And I hope
awesome.
You're enjoying it. Congratulations to the 8th graders. So what do people do when they go to the park? I mean, these carriage trails are open all year. The mansion is not, right? You can get a guided tour in the sort of warmer months in the summer. What else do people do? Christina?
Yeah, we have tours May through October and a great diversity of tours. Certainly a standard mansion tour that can visitors can go in and explore the mansion, which really shows the layers of the family's time on the estates from Billings to Rockefellers. And then we offer special programs into some of the lesser seen areas of the parks and lesser known histories of it. We offer an array of special events throughout the year. We just closed out our annual Trek to Taste on Saturday, which is a celebration of local trails and local foods that is put on by 30 community partners. We have several events coming up, including a music concert in July, our annual Forest Festival, which is a celebration of Vermont woods, in September, and another hiking event in October. But people experience the park in a great diversity of ways. Certainly tours, but the recreational opportunities are hiking and running and horseback riding. In the winter, the trails are maintained by the Woodstock Inn, and people can ski or snowshoe on those groomed trails. And people come to paint in the gardens or just meditate and reflect. So it really is used in a wonderful diversity of ways.
What do you like to do there, Rick?
Gosh, what do I not like to do there? the trails are just fantastic. And I've lived in Vermont now for close to 7 years, and there has not been a fall color season where I've not found myself out on the trails in Marsh Billings just enjoying the beauty of the fall colors reflected into the Pogue, which is the lake right in the middle of the park. It's a wonderful, magical place, and I'm very fortunate that I get to go there to work on most days, which is wonderful.
You know, Rick, we are celebrating the centennial of the National Park Service this year, and lots of different places talking about it, thinking about conservation. When you look at what's happening in Vermont and in our country today, how do you tie the sort of history of this park to what you're seeing today and where we're going?
Well, you know, the National Park Centennial is a great opportunity for us to sort of step back as a nation and take a look at what we've done over the last 100 years in terms of protecting some of our wildest places. You know, when the agency was first established in 1916, there were only 35 national parks, and I think only one of them was, you know, east of the Mississippi River, and now we're up to 411 of them, and they're located in every state and in many territories and in many urban areas around the country. There's so many people. I think by last count, about 80% of the U.S. population lives in urban areas around the country, and that's certainly not the case here in Vermont. But in terms of a national system of national parks, reaching out and being relevant to those people in urban areas and making them recognize that these places, these wild places, and places like Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine and out west are available to them and relevant to them in their everyday lives is an important step for keeping the National Park Service moving forward into its second century of stewardship. And so that's one of the pushes of the National Park Service during this 2016 centennial year is encouraging people to find their park wherever that may be. And it doesn't have to be a national park. It can be, you know, your local village green or the ball fields that your kids go and practice soccer or baseball or what have you on. You know, in Vermont, although we only have one national park in Marsh Billings Rockefeller, we also have 150 miles of the Appalachian Trail. We've got over 20 national historic landmarks like the Calvin Coolidge birthplace and the Vermont State House and the Stellafane Observatory in Springfield. The list goes on and on. We've got a little under 20 national landmarks like Mount Mansfield and the Camel's Hump and Lake Willoughby. All of these are places that the Park Service hopes that you will go out and find your park in this centennial year of the National Park Service, so that not only all our national parks, but all of our recreational and wild lands and historic places stay in the forefront of the ideals of the American people.
You know, Christina, Rick mentioned that more and more people are living in cities, and that's true around the world. And in many conservation circles, that's seen as needed to preserve agricultural spaces or to preserve wild spaces. So do you see, you know, that message of tying wilder lands, preserved lands, to people who may not live next to them anymore as something that is going to be a tension point in the coming century, or something that we'll be able to live pretty comfortably with?
It's a really interesting question, Jane. I think that connectivity is essential, and I think part of the work ahead of us is to perhaps try to remove some of those divides in our thinking so that we do see the ecology in the cities as just as important as the ecology in places that we might call wilderness, and that we are working collectively to think on a large landscape scale about that connectivity between those areas and how collectively from those urban to rural spectrums we're all serving as stewards for those places and keeping ecological function intact, as well as recognizing that environment, that ecology, is also essential to our communities, their identity, and our health and well-being.
Christina Martz is Deputy Superintendent of the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park. Rick Kendall is Superintendent of the park and the National Park Service Stewardship Institute. Christina and Rick, thank you so much for talking with us about your beloved park, Vermont's sole national park today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
We have a link up at vpr.net. Click on Vermont Edition if you want to learn more about Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historic Park. Coming up, Arnold Lobel is famous for his beloved Frog and Toad children's books. A new article in The New Yorker suggests his two main characters were maybe subtle representations of Lobel's own homosexuality. We'll talk with New Yorker writer Colin Stokes next on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This is Vermont Edition. My favorite story in Frog and Toad Together is Cookies. Let me summarize for you in case you have not read this book to a small child in many years or have not had a small child read it very slowly to you. Toad has baked some cookies. He takes them to Frog's house, and the two best friends cannot stop eating them. In an attempt to stop, they put the cookies in a box, tie the box in string, climb a ladder, and place the box high up in a closet. But still, they cannot stop themselves from eating these cookies. So Frog takes the cookies and throws them outside for the birds, at which point Toad, shocked and dismayed, goes home to bake himself a cake. Frog and Toad are the most famous and beloved creations of the children's author and illustrator Arnold Lobel. But it turns out Frog and Toad may not have been simply asexual amphibious friends. Colin Stokes is on the editorial staff of The New Yorker magazine. In the latest issue of the magazine, he wrote about the possible connection between Lobel's sexuality and his characters. Colin, welcome to Vermont Edition. What a pleasure to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's been reported that Arnold Lobel was actually inspired in his creation of these characters by summers he spent in Vermont. Thus, we can talk about this story on Vermont Edition. Remind us of why these characters are really seared into the brains of so many parents and so many now adult children.
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. For me personally, I just remember the humor of the books to be completely hilarious. I still, when I read through the books, I'm thinking particularly of the cookies I found to be very, very funny. And also there's a summer-appropriate one about ice cream in which Toad gets completely covered in two big cones of ice cream that he's bringing to Frog and appears to be a monster that scares all of the animals in the pond. But I think that the humor is very... very strong and sort of and sweet and simple, and I think also a main part is that they have a really touching and loving relationship.
Yes, these are two friends, and they're together in four books. In fact, you know, Frog and Toad Together is one of the books. Frog and Toad Are Friends, Frog and Toad All Year. And these books were published between 1970 and 1979. Tell us a little bit about Arnold LaBelle, what he was like.
So I from my conversations with his daughter, he sounds like an extremely sweet and intelligent man. I think she told me a really wonderful story about how he they were on a road trip together as a family, and she was in the back of the car with her young brother, and they were having a fight, and she said that he recited a story to them that he'd just written in his head, which was actually I think Martha the Movie Mouse, which is a book that he later published.
And this is in verse. I mean, this is not just a story that he's sort of making up the words as he goes along.
Yes, which is absolutely incredible. And as somebody who writes makes me extremely envious, to be honest. I wish that I were able to do something like that. And she's sort of another wonderful story that she told me was about how he would draw in the day, and he would in the evening he would write, and she still has his notebooks from when he was writing, and looking through them, that there's almost no edits or no corrections to the original way in which he wrote things out. So these stories often just came almost fully formed, which is really quite something.
And it was his daughter, right, who actually made many of these books in color. His drawings were pen and ink or graphite, just black and white.
So the original, there are a couple of them that were or published for the first time in around 2009, I believe, that she colored, but the original set, I think, did come in color. Although it is an interesting, she was telling me about how back in the day, the way in which one made color as an artist and was quite laborious. So you were only able to, you only got a set of colors, a very restricted number of colors, and you had to just paint them in as sort of densities in gray. So you never really knew what a book was going to look like until it was printed, which sounds terrifying as well.
I'm speaking with Colin Stokes. He's the author of an article in the New Yorker magazine called Frog and Toad, An Amphibious Celebration of Same-Sex Love. Now, Arnold LaBelle married a woman named Anita Kempler, and as you mentioned, they had children together. And then he came out to his family in 1974. What made you draw the connection between LaBelle's sexuality and the characters of Frog and Toad?
Well, I was sort of, it seems they do have a very close relationship. They're two amphibians of the same sex. Really, it was my conversation with Adrian that sort of highlighted the connection. She said that she thinks it was really the beginning of him coming out.
Creating these characters was, you think, the beginning of him coming out?
The the series Frog and Toad was the beginning of him coming out. And it's there are other places, I think, in which he's sort of talked about how Frog and Toad was the first time he felt like he was writing about himself, and that he would sort of draw from his own personal experience and put his personal experiences into books, into his children's books. And so I think it's a not unreasonable conclusion to arrive at.
You know, this is not the first time that questions have been raised about two intimate friends who are prominent in children's lives and share the same gender or have what adults might think of as sort of an intriguing or an ambiguous setup. And, of course, thinking of Bert and Ernie, the most famous examples. Now, the Sesame Workshop has said basically they're not gay, they're not straight, they're puppets. It doesn't matter. So is this just sort of gossip for adults like, ooh, Frog and Toad, maybe they represent gay characters? Or does it matter if Lobel was intending his characters to represent something more than just platonic friendship?
It's an interesting question. I think that it's very important to be able to be open to readings like that, in which I think that often people will reject those readings because they're uncomfortable with the notion of homosexuality, which and I think that is distressing, obviously. So I think that firstly, it's important to be open to that kind of reading, even if it's, you know, not necessarily my familiarity with the response about Bert and Ernie is not what it could be. But I think it's important to be open to that reading, and also I think that it's you know, the fact that there is this biographical detail for Lobel makes it more convincing. They were written around the time when he was sort of coming to terms with his sexuality.
So in a way, it's sort of a normalization, even within children's literature, that even if it's not the focus, not explicit, kids might see their families or their feelings sort of portrayed in these stories in a way that's just out there.
Yeah, I think so. I've been getting a lot of really wonderful responses on Twitter and emails from friends, and I think one of the threads that I've come across is that people saying now it makes sense how much I liked these books, because it sort of was an early relationship that I could understand that I actually would want later down the line. And that was, I think that's very important for children to have that as a normal thing, to see that same-sex relationships are very normal.
Colin Stokes is on the editorial staff of The New Yorker. His article is Frog and Toad, an Amphibious Celebration of Same-Sex Love. Colin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll put a link to that article up at vpr.net. Before we go today, we're going to read some of your emails and comments. I'm joined by Vermont Edition producer Rick Sangari. Hi, Rick.
Hey there, Jane. On Friday's show, we talked about the incredible climate events of 1816, when ash from a huge volcanic eruption in Indonesia filled the atmosphere and blocked much of the sunlight in our region, leading the year to be named the Year Without a Summer, or 1800 and Froze to Death.
We can read you a couple of notes we got from there. Michelle says, I think we'll see something similar in our lifetime. People need to be more prepared. Forget doomsday. People aren't even prepared for a three-day snowstorm these days.
It's dark. Also on that show, a caller mentioned an area in Vermont that became known as Egypt after a farmer's crops there succeeded when those of all the neighbors were killed by the freeze. A listener, Jerose, filled in some of the blanks on Facebook. Jerose wrote, the rough story is a new homesteader in this area was not finished clearing stumps that year, and to the initial scorn of his neighbors, proceeded to plant corn without the field being fully cleared. The farmer then began to burn down the stumps, which performed like smudge pots in orchards fighting a freeze. The result was his corn crop was the only one in the area to have produced grain.
And Giroux continued, he said, apparently bankers in St. Albans offered top price for the corn. Instead, the farmer sold his corn grain and seed at fair prices to other local growers, earning their admiration. A story in the Bible referred to the stores of grain in Egypt, and thus this part of East Fairfield was given that name.
And a couple of weeks back, we talked about fun and affordable activities for kids in the summertime. We got some additional suggestions from listeners. CJ emailed, our local library in Shelburne, Pearson Library, has a museum pass program. Many libraries have these. It gives at least two tickets, some four, to area museums for free. We love this program.
We have that at my local library as well. We have lots of suggestions up. You can go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, and you can find that show page to learn more about how to entertain yourself and your kids this summer. Rick, thanks for sharing some mailbags
ideas
with us.
Sure, yeah.
You can always shoot us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net about anything you've heard on the show. Now, ridgeline views and the promise of rugged adventure draw a lot of us into hiking trails and into the backcountry. Returning with a few scratches and bug bites is to be expected, but what should you be prepared to handle when you strike out on a backpacking trip or even a day hike? Tomorrow on the show, we'll get a reality check on hiker and backpacker safety and how to plan a self-sufficient adventure that mitigates some of the risks. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, as well as Meg Malone, with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.